And thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward, and from the George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Well, one day, Kevin Sowen and his daughter Hannah were stopped at a traffic light next to a Mercedes-Benz. Hannah saw a homeless man on the corner at the same time and said, "You know, Dad, if that man had a less nice car, that man there could have a meal." Well, that observation spurred the family to try and make a small difference in a big way in the world. Hannah and Kevin join me in the studio to discuss their decision and their book. The book is titled The Power of Half. Kevin, welcome to you.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
Hannah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And Kevin, we should point out you're a reporter, editor with the Wall Street Journal for more than 18 years, so you have some journalistic wind at your back.
A little bit.
You are now a junior, is that right?
Yes. Well, I'm about to be a senior now.
In high school.
Yes.
From Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. All right. The Power of Half. What are we talking about here? Go ahead, Hannah.
Go ahead.
You start.
Okay. The book is a lot about kind of our family's journey through this project where we after kind of this incident at the stoplight with the Mercedes and the homeless man, after that we kind of went home and we talked to my mom and my brother about the situation and about what had happened. And I remember feeling very angry at myself and at my family mainly because I knew that there was so much more that I could be doing in the community.
What were you angry about?
Just because I knew that we had so much and others had so little, and I was angry about the injustices in the world. And I remember saying to my family, I don't want to be the type of family that just sits there and says, I wish that we could do something. I really wanted to get out there, and I want to make a difference.
Kevin, the difference, the power of half, why half? What's that?
Well, what we did was we decided to sell our house, move into a house half the size, and give away half of the sales price of the original home to help end poverty in the developing world.
Is there some significance to half, not a quarter, not a third, not a tenth, not three quarters?
Part of it was we decided to test whether we could live in half a house, if we could live in a place half the size. And once we did that, when we realized that the price difference was half, we started to recognize that half was a fairly easy and measurable metric. And so, you know, I'll say this right out of the chute. We don't expect anybody else to sell their house. You know, that's kind of a crazy and ridiculous thing.
You're not
do.
Here. This isn't a tome to say everybody should follow our example.
No.
We should all live on half of what we've got.
No, but we do believe that everybody can live on half of something in their lives, whether it's their time or their stuff or their money. You know, one of the great examples that we like to use is, you know, if you spend 6 hours a week surfing the internet, or, you know, playing on Facebook or whatever, cut that in half. Cut that to three. Get together with your family or your community or your dorm and say, okay, I now have a resource, a brand new resource of 3 hours completely free. Now how do I want to use that? Do I want to help kids in a cancer clinic? Do I want to help, you know, do I want to help people in a nursing home? Do I want to sort food in a food bank? So many things you can do.
Hannah, you gave away half your stuff?
Not exactly. We gave away half the house, which kind of meant that we gave away half the stuff.
No, I'm asking you what you gave away.
I think that I did give away half my stuff because my room was packed.
So what kind of stuff did you get rid of?
For one thing, I got rid of my iPod, and I got rid of a ton of clothes, like definitely half of my clothes. What else did I get rid of half of?
Almost all the electronics in your life.
Yeah, almost all the electronics. That's very true, yeah.
And so set the scene for us here. Mm-hmm. What was this house like that you were living in that you decided to sell? What was this life that you had built for yourself because you had good incomes and had climbed the ladder of American success?
Well, and I should preface this by saying this is not a trust fund story. My wife and I grew up the kids of four school teachers. We got great educations. We worked very hard. We achieved, and we made really more money than we had anticipated. And as we did, we accumulated stuff. I think that's what people do. You know, your neighbor buys a nice TV. You go over there, you say, hey, the Super Bowl's coming up. I need a nice TV. Well, there's probably nothing wrong with the TV you have, but you need a nicer one, a bigger one. And we did that, you know, in most of the facets in our life, you know, from the clothing that we would buy. You'd buy a nice pair of jeans, and you'd say, okay, well, I need a nice jacket to go with that nice pair of jeans. Oh, man, I can't have a nice jacket and nice jeans without nice shoes to go with it. So the accumulation almost happens on autopilot in many ways. You know, Joan and I started to refer to it as the treadmill. You know, we just have to keep staying in motion.
Did you actually feel like you were working to keep up with the Joneses? Was this
Joneses and the Smiths and the Williams and everybody else you could name?
But you don't really feel it. It's kind of, like you said, you're kind of on autopilot, so you're not totally aware of it all the time. So when we kind of stopped and we said, look at the injustices in the world, this isn't fair, we actually realized that that was our life, that we were trying to keep up with the Joneses.
So tell me about your house, because this wasn't just your basic house.
Oh, this wasn't a basic house. Joan would always describe this home as her dream home. This was a beautiful 6,000 square foot house, two-story Corinthian columns, wraparound porches. It was the kind of home that people would stop on the street and take photographs of. And it was in Midtown Atlanta, just, you know, in a beautiful historic neighborhood that was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted. And, you know, it was... you know, the kitchen had three Viking stoves.
You had three stoves in your
three
kitchen?
Three stoves.
What do you do with three stoves?
We didn't use them.
That's a lot of scrambled eggs.
Yeah, we ordered in pizza like everybody else did. You know, and
cut that in half too?
Cut that. Well, actually, we do have a pizza thing where we're ordering less pizza and we're getting Trader Joe's frozen pizza, and then we put $5 in a bin and we use that for
the
food
crust.
Bank. Eat the crust. Always eat everything. You know, but the home. Home was kind of that was the peak of our accumulation. If you had looked at us at this point in our lives, this is 2006 when Hannah stopped us. If you had looked at us at this point in our lives, you would have said, the most important relationship in the Selwyn's life is with their stuff.
Did you feel this before your daughter said, Dad, look at that Mercedes and that homeless guy there?
No.
I think you're a journalist. You're paid to ask questions.
Yeah, we felt that we were privileged, that we had earned a lot, that we had responsibility to give. And so for years, I've been building Habitat houses. I'm on the local affiliate board
down
there.
So you were doing charity things along
the way. We're doing charity things. We were involved with the community. You know, Hannah likes to work at the food bank and a night shelter for homeless men, you know. And so we're out there in the community. And in fact, when Hannah stopped us after that initial Mercedes and homeless man meeting, you know, Joan and I kept trying to explain to her, well, Han, we do a lot. You know, we write nice checks at Christmas time. You know, we're out there in the community. We're doing things. And all I could see in Hannah's eyes was this look of, this is the lamest junk I've ever heard.
Is that true, Hannah?
It's kind of true. I mean, they were kind of naming things and trying to, like, they were defensive about how much we gave. And that was just pathetic to me.
The name of the book is The Power of Half, One Family's Decision to Stop Taking and Start Giving Back, talking with Kevin and Hannah Selwyn. Hannah, was this always something that you walked around with from the time you were a two-year-old, this sort of sense of injustice in the world, making things right? Were you the person who captured the flies before your father could kill them and let them outside? Or, I mean, where did this all come from?
To be honest, you know, I get that question, and I honestly don't know. I don't know if it was something that that I was born with, this feeling of, you know, how unfair the world is or whatever. But I think that it's definitely something that everyone has. And I think that, you know, it's just the right time for some people. And it was the right time for me at that moment at the stoplight where I said, this is wrong and I need to do something about it.
Something clicked.
Yes.
Something clicked. If you have questions for Hannah or Kevin Selwyn, we'll be taking your calls and your emails but in a few minutes in the broadcast. That's 1-800-433-8850, 1-800-433-8850, or you can call us at drshow@wamu.org. Again, the book is The Power of Half, One Family's Decision to Stop Taking and Start Giving Back. Kevin, you begin your book by describing a ribbon-cutting ceremony in a faraway place.
Yeah.
What was the ceremony and what was the place?
This was the opening of a corn mill in Ghana, Africa, where what happened after that initial conversation, you know, at the stoplight and then the dinner table, was that once we decided to sell our home, we spent close to a year trying to figure out how to invest the money. And this was kind of an amazing process. We had gotten very good, and I think a lot of us are very good, at investing money to make more money.
Oh, no, I invest money and seem to lose it. I need to read your other book.
I guess so. But this was something completely different. It was a question of how do we make money, how do we invest money to make change in the world or to help people make their own change in the world. And we didn't know how to do that, and there really was no roadmap. And so we spent close to a year trying to figure out where we wanted to invest our dollars and how we wanted to do it. And so we, after a year of voting and learning about each other and exploring each other's values, we realized that we wanted to invest our money to try to take on world poverty in a small piece of the world.
I mean, take on world poverty, that's a gigantic, maybe even overwhelming goal.
It is, and it is a goal that at sometimes, if you look at it in its totality, it is overwhelming.
So you got to Ghana?
Yes. We ended up working with an organization, or teaming up with an organization called The Hunger Project. And in 2008, we went to Ghana and we saw the work that they kind of do there. They really believe in the people on the ground, and they really believe in the African spirit, that the people are their own change agents. And we really love that. So when we went there, it was really unbelievable.
And this was part of a trip that you were taking, or part of the investigation you were doing to see where to put this money? This was sort of your own...
Yeah, we wanted to see what was happening on the ground. And once we had decided on the Hunger Project, we called them up and we said, we're interested in investing in you, but we'd like to go over there.
And did it change your life, Hannah, going to Ghana?
It definitely did.
I mean, you saw things you'd never seen before?
Yes. I mean, the people there were just unbelievably friendly, and it was just a whole culture that I, you know, was so lucky to experience.
The book is The Power of Half by Kevin and Salwan, by Kevin and Hannah Salwan. One family's decision to stop taking and start giving back. Your phone calls, your questions for our authors, and more discussion about what it takes to give back after a brief break. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane. Diane will be back with you on Friday. We're talking with Kevin and Hannah Salwan. They're authors of The Power of Half, One Family's Decision to Stop Taking and Start Giving Back. Father-daughter, dynamic duo here. We were talking about going to Ghana and seeing this incredible, life-changing moment for you, Hannah. As you witnessed this scene that could not have been different, more different from this private school, girls' school?
Yes.
Girls' school environment in Atlanta. I mean, talk about a bubble, right?
Right, definitely. And this was the first time that my brother Joseph and I had kind of been the other. We both went to great private schools in the middle of a really affluent part of Atlanta. And it was kind of the first time that we were really being the one where people point their fingers and call us names, not mean names, but, you know, notice that we're different. And that was really interesting for us. That was really the first time that that had ever really happened to us, and it was interesting.
How did you decide on Ghana and not more Habitat for Humanity or Appalachia or any number of places in this country that are so in need?
We decided, first of all, that we were already working in the U.S., as I said, I'm on the Habitat board, and we do work with the food bank and shelters in Atlanta. And in fact, during this process, we increased both the number of hours and the number of dollars we donate to our local community. But with this money, we decided, number one, we wanted to help build a safety net in places in which there is none at all. Number two, we wanted to get involved with a project we felt we could go start to finish. And so with the Hunger Project, we decided to work on this 5-year program that they use to help rural villagers move from poverty to self-reliance. And number three is that, you know, we felt our money could go further overseas.
How much money are we talking about here?
Over $800,000.
$800,000 that you gave away, or $800,000 you sold the house for?
No, $800,000 we gave away, or we're giving away. It's phased in. Yeah, it's phased in.
So you sold
in.
The house for mm-hmm. $1.6 million? Is that the presumption?
We actually sold it for less. We ran into the teeth of the real estate recession, and so we ended up selling it for a little over $1.4 million. So we committed to the $800,000 that we were giving away.
What are you living in now?
We're living in a perfectly comfortable, smaller home. Not a dream home, but I mean, a vanilla home is really what it is. Mm-hmm. But to be honest with you, Frank, our lives are better. You know, we live tighter. We live more connected with each other. And that's really kind of the, you know, you asked earlier about the power of half. The power of half for us is the amazing transformation in our family's relationship. You know, essentially, if you think about it, what we did was we gave away a little bit of stuff, and we traded that for more connectedness, a tighter relationship with our family, within our family, and more trust in one another.
Hannah, what did your friends say about what you're doing?
My friends have been just unbelievably supportive. People at school have been unbelievably supportive. You know, there's sometimes some teasing. You know, every time I say something, someone's like, well, why don't you write a book about it? But, you know, it's just funny and nice. But my friends have been unbelievably supportive. Two of my friends have decided to donate half of their babysitting money to environmental organizations. One of my friends also decided to clean out half of her closet. So,
have any of your friends gone home and told their parents they should do the same thing your crazy parents have done?
Not to that extreme, but there have been, you know, some passionate people going home.
And we do a lot of talking to schools, and you hear phenomenal things coming out of schools. You know, we'll get emails from kids with their own ideas of, you know, one school up in Rye, New York, said that they wanted to time their showers and reduce the length of their showers by half.
Let me ask you both to put on your headphones so you can hear the telephone callers, and I'm going to go to the callers now. And I want to start with John from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, John. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead with your question.
Great. Thank you for having me. First, I want to commend the author and your daughter. I have a 16-year-old, and I hope she can be inspired by this story as well as you did with your daughter. So congratulations for that.
I wanted to
ask you a tough question, which when you look at the comparison of the Mercedes and the homeless person, that is a contradiction that youth can interpret as one having excess and the other not, and yet it is really often the efficient working of capitalism, which isn't always pretty. And I just want to know if you had a conversation with your daughter or others about that sort of complexity that sometimes can't be boiled down to a simple comparison. And I'm going to drop off and listen to your answer on the air.
I think that's a terrific question, John. And yes, in fact, we have had those conversations. You know, we are not anti-capitalist. We're not anti-wealth. We still earn money. We give away half of what we earn often, and we certainly are for the book. But we do believe that there is a consumer engine that absolutely needs to drive our economy, and that's important. What Hannah's activity did for us was, if you think about a road, it was essentially a speed bump, and it just said slow down and take a careful look around. And for us, when we did that, we said, you know what, there's all of these things that we have more than enough of. We don't need them. We could be perfectly happy. Little did we know we'd be even happier, but we could be perfectly happy living in a smaller place. And, you know, we walk past that house now all the time, and we realize that that home, selling that home, gave us the opportunity to have over 30,000 people in villages in Africa wake up this morning and say, I have a little more opportunity than I did yesterday.
30,000 people. Explain the number.
Well, we're funding several sets of villages as they move on this journey from poverty to self-reliance through the Hunger Project's work. And what they do is they cluster villages to work together to build their own future.
Hannah, You know, it's an interesting question John raised a moment ago. Because when you saw that homeless person, your presumption, in a sense, was Mercedes there, homeless guy there. That's fundamentally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that that man may have been homeless for any number of reasons. Not because the guy in the Mercedes was taking something away from him or that there was an injustice there. The homeless person may have been homeless because he was down on his luck or because he was suffering from some kind of mental illness or because there was there are any number of reasons.
Definitely. And that, I think that kind of goes back to the fact that I was 14 at the time. And, I wasn't really, educated on capitalism or any of the other, various reasons why this man could be homeless or why, the man in the Mercedes, we almost definitely made his money and deserved to have that Mercedes. And now kind of thinking back, it's much more about the message that was taken away from that day than the actual, disparity that I was actually seeing.
Back to the phones. Michelle joins us from Coconut Creek, Florida. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
Hi, Michelle. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. I am constantly fighting that battle in my house with my husband, who loves his electronics. And I would like to get my children out there doing more for the community and wanted to know if you have any advice for me to do that. I have a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old.
All right, so I'm going to ask you, do you want to start with Hannah, or do you want to start with her dad? Which generation do you want to hear from first?
Oh, it doesn't matter. Okay. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks. Hannah?
I would say I think that the main way to get kids involved is exposure. Because a lot of times kids don't really know what makes them angry. Anger is just a major driver for a project like this. And I think that exposing them to, maybe taking them to the Humane Society one weekend, but then also taking them to an elderly home the next weekend and then maybe to a homeless shelter the next weekend. But also having, going out for donuts afterwards or going out for bagels so that you guys can discuss or so that they don't feel like it's really a punishment.
Next question from Daniel in Salisbury, North Carolina. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and I want to commend it to you for the outstanding job that you are doing in Ghana, where I come from. And to highlight your point, I was there like 2 weeks ago on a vacation. I left home when I was like 21, and it's about 20-something years ago, 23 years ago. Only to go back and see how people live in poverty and their day-to-day life is just a survival. And I came back home to tell my wife that I want to start something. Not that I live big, large, but I have an opportunity, and this is a chance for me to help people back home to get a life that we take for granted here. Things like 3 square meals a day and stuff like that. And I want to thank you for the good job that you are doing, you and your daughter.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank
Kevin?
You. Daniel, I think it's very easy sometimes for people in the United States to pay attention to what they see around them and not what they don't see. And I think that's a very human trait. And it wasn't until we started looking at the question of poverty and hunger that we started to recognize that most poverty and hunger is not the kids with the distended bellies and the ribs poking through. It was people who are working 16 hours a day, who are just trying to put enough food in front of their children and then pay school fees and then get uniforms for their kids, just so that they can move up one notch on that ladder.
We're talking to Kevin Solomon and Hannah Solomon, and they are the authors, father-daughter, The Power of Half, One Family's Decision to Stop Taking and Start Giving Back. Kevin, I want to ask you this. To go from the Mercedes moment, where Hannah sees the homeless guy in the Mercedes and puts 2 and 3 together and comes up with 5 and says, give half of it away, which is more complicated math than I can do quickly. But to go from that to we'll sell the house, we'll give half away, we'll completely change everything, I mean, that didn't take place in an hour. What was that process like, and how did you actually get to the point where the family, your wife, your son, all 4 of you agree, yeah, this is something we're going to do?
It was that sort of quick, irrational moment,
And, right there.
And
right.
Well, Hannah and Joan clearly agreed. It took me about a day, but I love a challenge. I mean, I think it's, you know, I just think it, I thought the project would be fun.
Who came up with the idea?
It was actually Joan.
Your wife?
Yeah. And really it was after listening to Hannah, you know, keep talking about, I want to be a family that makes a difference. I want to be a family that makes a difference. Joan finally said, well, what do you want to do? You want to sell the house? And Hannah said, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. You know, and I like to joke that Joseph and I fainted right there on the spot.
And what did your wife, because you said it was her dream house.
Yeah, but...
So what was her response when Hannah said, yeah, I do? What did your mom say?
First of all, it was kind of a test to see how far I was really, you know, willing to go with this whole idea. And so when I said yes, I think it kind of took her by surprise, but, you know, when she was saying if she's willing to give up her room, willing to give up her house, willing to give up everything that she has, well, then I should be willing to do that too. And I would think it was like kind of right then that she said, okay, definitely, we'll do that.
Yeah, and for me, it started to dawn on me during that day afterward that we had a chance to define ourselves as a family not by the stuff we own, but by what we gave. And that was kind of a fascinating challenge for us.
Back to the phones. Megan is calling from Silver Spring, Maryland. Hi, Megan.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I am a social worker, so I am certainly delighted by this topic. And Hannah, it really struck me when you said that when you and your family went to Ghana, that was you and your brother's first experience with being the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not fortunate enough to have that experience until I was an adult when I was in a meeting I worked with adolescents in a juvenile justice facility. And I looked around the room and I was the only white person in the room.
Right.
And it was kind of shocking for me. I mean, I grew up in a very solidly white middle-class area, and that had never happened to me before. And that, for me, was kind of the moment that I started to get it. And I'm wondering if you've been able to give any of your peers and other teenagers that kind of experience as well, because I think that can be the most life-changing moment for people.
It definitely was for us, you know, after Joe and I left. I mean, we were literally the only white people that we saw for days at a time. You know, I think we went 10 days being the only white people. And it's really hard, I think, to be able to share that experience, to be able to say, listen, you know, this is how you feel being the other. But I have kind of tried to do my best when educating kind of my peers on the topic. For example, my friend Laura and I decided to do a hunger week at my school this year. And during that week, we had one day where we decorated the school to look like Kenya. And we kind of gave out these slips of paper that said, you know, first period, you're going to go carry water. Second period, you're going to go collect firewood. Third period, you have unfortunately gotten your period, so you can't attend school today. And we had a bunch of different things where people could see kind of what it was like to be a Kenyan girl not being able to go to school and not even be able to get her education because she needs to work. And I think that was kind of our way of getting the point across.
And I think, you know, the fascinating thing for kids is they need to experience things. And, you know, Hannah talked about exposure for younger kids. I would also encourage parents, for example, to let their kids lead. You know, a lot of times we say, well, you know, we have to go work at the soup kitchen because that's what I, the parent, care about. Well, let's face it, there's so many problems in the world that could use our attention. What's wrong with having the kid lead and fix, you know, and work on that problem for a while?
Let's go to Deborah, who's calling in from Bainbridge, Ohio. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I first want to say that I admire your family's courage to let go. And my question is, what was the reaction from your friends and your social circles that you ran in when you were accumulating things and, quote unquote, keeping up with the Joneses?
You mean after that?
Yeah.
It was fascinating because we've lost some friends over this.
You've lost friends over
this? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Why?
Absolutely.
Why?
You know,
do they think you're passing judgment on their lifestyle?
I think they pass judgment on their lifestyle. And maybe they think we're passing judgment. You know, I think when you're in a social circle, it's very comfortable to keep moving in that same direction.
Do they think you're some kind of crazy activist or something like that, and they're uncomfortable around you now?
Or we're grandstanding show-offs or something. But you know, it's funny because Joan was explaining to one of her close friends what we were doing. And this woman started crying at the breakfast table. And she said, "That's not my family's reality."
What does that mean?
I think she means we don't earn enough money that we could give away a home or half a home. And so maybe I'm not a good parent. I don't know. It's very difficult to get to the real root issue with some people. But we have lost friends over it. It's funny.
We're talking with Kevin and Hannah Salwin. They are the authors of The Power of Half, One Family's Decision to Stop Taking and Start Giving Back. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. Be back after a short break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Tarcher Penguin, with Jeremy Rifkin's new book, The Empathic Civilization: The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, in stores and online. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Daily Show correspondent Samantha Bee. She's reported on everything from the scourge of progressivism to press conferences where married politicians confess they've had affairs.
If there's one business event your spouse should probably be excused from, it's the one where you explain how you've betrayed them.
Samantha Bee talks about The Daily Show and her new memoir on the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Diane will be back on Friday. We are speaking this hour with Kevin Salwin and his daughter Hannah. They are the authors of The Power of Half, One Family's Decision to Stop Taking and Start Giving Back. They sold their house. They cut everything in half? Most things in half?
Just about everything.
And they've devoted that money to a project in Ghana as part of their giving back. Now, you mentioned a moment ago, Kevin, that you lost some friends over this, and it strikes you, as odd to begin with, that something, a gesture so generous, could strike people. But some might see it as moralistic. Some might see it as passing judgment on others' values. We have an interesting email from Terry, who emails us from St. Louis, Missouri. What you're doing is commendable, but it sounds as though your lifestyle was at worst upper middle class. It sounds as if you were on the border between upper class, middle, and upper middle class. And Terry continues, Americans tend to be some of the most generous people on the face of the earth, but how can you realistically ask middle class and working class people to give more? We're in a time of recession where people don't have jobs or who have had to take pay cuts. Have your children ever experienced a true middle class or working class situation in this country?
They certainly have experienced it with other people. You know, when Hannah was born, we weren't making that much money. But look, I'm not crying poverty here in any way. I think we live a very good lifestyle. We lived an extraordinary lifestyle. We'd still live a very good lifestyle, and that gets to a really crucial point. We don't believe that giving needs to be sacrificial. We don't believe in the good give till it hurts model. You know, it's not sustainable. We give because it feels good, because it feels great, in fact. And so that for us is the motivator. You know, I always refer to this project as the most self-interested thing we ever did, because it did great things for our family. It brought us closer together. We did a little bit of good in the world, and we're doing a little bit of good in the world. And I just want to say one other thing about the emailed question, and that is, we believe that during a time of recession, when people are having to cut back, we're at least offering the message that you can be happy with less, and sometimes it's forced, and sometimes it's not your choice. But you can be happy with
less. When it's forced, it's a very different experience.
It is a different experience, and I don't minimize that, Frank. Not in the least.
That's very painful because
agreed.
You know,
agreed.
You may be in a hole, and you find yourself getting deeper in a hole. Not many people live a surplus existence.
Very true, and you know, people have gotten extended, and you know, they lease cars, and they use credit cards, and I do understand that.
On this topic, Patrick joins us from Remsen, New York. Hi, Patrick. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Kevin. Not to beseech your achievements, and I do commend you for what you've done, but as you stated earlier, that this would be fun, like what you're doing with your family. With 17% of Americans unemployed, living on half has become a reality. I lost my job over a year ago, and we're not finding much opportunity for employment, you know, making what I made in the past. We've had to learn to live with half. We sold possessions. We've come close to losing the house. We're back on bills, and to us, it's not fun or a game. You know, it's just become a reality, a way of life. And I just want to make that statement that, you know, there's a lot of us out there who it's just not a game to us. You know.
Thanks, Patrick.
And I think first of all, I'm sorry for the hardship you've been going through. It sounds like your family and you have really had a tough time, and I empathize. One of the things I want to make absolutely clear is that money and stuff aren't necessarily the things you need to give away. Patrick, in your case, you know, I don't see this as a game. I see it as a bit of an opportunity for you to be out there in the community for others, giving of your time. And I think, you know, oftentimes we don't recognize that, you know, being out there for others in any way is really healthy for ourselves. The increasingly research is starting to show that there's this activity in the brain that's very similar to a runner's high. And in fact, they've started to call it the giver's high because it's an endorphin release from the charitable work that you do. Absolutely, giving time is a perfect use. And I think it helps people feel more connected and have more of a sense of meaning.
Well, we never said this was going to be a picnic for you, so I want to read another email for you because it's interesting how this conversation and this topic prompts a couple of very different responses from people. Many, and we've got more callers, we'll get back to them in a minute, who say this is very encouraging and inspiring, and others who have different feelings provoked. This is an email from Deborah who writes, "These people may have given something, but I'm still not impressed. They now buy Trader Joe's pizza instead of ordering out. I can afford neither, and I still give to those less fortunate than myself. They may no longer have three stoves, but certainly the one they have in their home must be a top-of-the-line gourmet stove. I'm not trying to pick on them, because certainly doing something is better than doing nothing, but their soapbox is a little flimsy." Deborah asks, "What about the proceeds from the book?"
The end part of the question I can answer. About the proceeds from the book. All the proceeds from the book are going to the Hunger Project. And also, if you look on the back of the book, it says that every book that's sold, the publisher, Houghton Mifflin, will donate $1 to Rebuilding Together, which is an organization that keeps the elderly and disabled in their homes.
Yeah, let me address the first part of the question. We are not trying to impress anyone. We're trying to make a difference in the world. And this is our method of doing it. I think there are lots of methods. And we just encourage people to look into their own lives, figure out what they have more than enough of, divide it in half, and get together as a family or a community and be out there in the world for others.
A call from Anna Maria in South Bend, Indiana. Hi, Anna Maria.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, my comment is that I want to congratulate you what you people are doing and to say that for me is such an inspiration. I have been thinking, yes, I have enough. I am rich. I'm not rich. It's a simple life, but better and more than many, many poor people in the whole world. I came from Brazil, from a poor family, and now I have so much, not a lot, but enough to live very comfortable. But what really gets me is my closet. I go there and I look at all my dresses and clothes. I said, gosh, why do I need that much? I know I don't need it. I have been thinking give away. But after that talk, so I want to thank you for being this program, because after this program, I now am going to do what I have been thinking and doing and not being so, such a consumerist that keeps going out to the store and buy and buy and buy.
So, Anna Maria, what will you do differently now?
I'm sorry?
What did you? So you say now you're going to do, you're not going to do what you've been doing. So what will you do differently beyond just not buy so much?
I'm going to try to not buy so much, because I go to the store, I see something, oh, that's a good price, I'll buy. And I don't need that. And I tell myself, I keep all the time with a dilemma in my mind. Do I not? I always think, okay, I should not. I'm being consumeristic. I should not do that. I should not. But I end up buying.
Okay.
Now I'm going. It's going to be a very good inspiration and a good point for me to start today, to not start buying things and give half of my things, my clothes, away.
You're going to give half your clothes. Hannah, what's your response to this?
I just wanted to say thank you so much for calling in. It's definitely people like you that are inspiring us. You're such an inspiration yourself. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Do you find that when you talk to people about this topic and when they read the book and when they talk to you that, Hannah, that people respond a lot like this and they say they're going to do something differently?
Yeah, a majority of people are very positive. You know, I've had a lot of friends that have done things. A lot of my dad's friends have been really supportive. When we go and we do talks, we hear tons of ideas like this about giving away half of the clothes or really at least being more mindful of the things that we purchase.
Kevin, what was the hardest single part of this?
It's funny. When most of the time when we move, we upsize and we head to, if you don't know where to put something, you stick it in the attic. Or you stick it in the basement. We didn't have an attic. And our basement doesn't have any storage space. And so every single item that we looked at, we had to decide, do we throw it away? Do we give it to Goodwill? Or do we keep it? And if we decided to keep it, we had to find a place for it.
Loretta joins us now from Princeton Junction, New Jersey. Hi, Loretta.
Hi. I have this theory that people don't feel rich. And my community is Central New Jersey, a very wealthy community. But I think most people here feel like they're just maybe upper middle class. And if you define any universe that this community's in, we're rich. And the bigger universe you get, the richer we are. But we don't feel like we're rich. And probably the writers didn't feel like they were rich either.
Did you feel rich?
Until they realized they didn't need what they had.
Yeah. Did you feel rich?
We would never have used the word rich. We certainly knew we had more than most, and we didn't worry about money particularly. But, the point that she makes is such a great one. And if we do get a response from a lot of people, you know, I'll hear from friends of mine who are working on Wall Street and making a couple million dollars a year, and they'll say, boy, I wish I could do that. I wish I could do something like that. But, you know, what happens down the road if you run out? And
how is it that people who are earning that kind of money, which is multiples of what the basic American family lives on, never mind what families who've lost their jobs or lost their means are experiencing, could possibly think they don't have enough?
You know, I think one of the things is we do build a lifestyle around what we earn.
It's a mindset, I think, definitely, is that, you know, the more you make, the more you want. And the more, you know, I think we were once talking to a man who said, we were talking about the difference, you know, should you lead, should you live a life of giving? Like, should you be a nurse or a teacher or something, or work in the nonprofit world? Or should you, you know, be a lawyer or a doctor and make a ton of money and then decide to give it away? And he said something interesting, that once you're a lawyer, or once, you know, you're making a ton of money, you look back when you're 40 and say, you know, look how much money I've made, but, like, imagine how much money I could make if I worked until I was 60. And I thought that that was really interesting, is that it never kind of ends. That's kind of another type of treadmill, is that you need to make more and more and more to really feel satisfied.
We're talking with Hannah and Kevin Sawin. They are authors of The Power of Half, One Family's Decision to Stop Taking and Start Giving Back. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today, who will be back on Friday. If you'd like to join us in our remaining moments, 1-800-433-8850, or you can email us at drshow@wamu.org. Rhonda calls in now from Little Rock, Arkansas. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. I was just kind of wanting to give my take, because there's been various points of views given. And, you know, Bill Gates gives millions of dollars every year. He's still a very rich man. These folks, they gave half, and they're still comfortable, but that does not negate what they have done or what their state of mind is. My father, who was always a fairly poor man, I'd see him take the last dollar out of his pocket and give it to someone. I never went hungry, don't get me wrong, but I was telling the person that I talked to before, if someone had asked me, can you dedicate $30 or $40 a week to help feed someone that's hungry, I would have said no. I'm a single mom. I make $45,000 a year. But there was a family at my son's school, and my son is 9, and he wanted to help. So we dedicated to do that, and he goes shopping for them. And what I have found is it works out. And sometimes if there's something I can't buy, you know, that would be like an extra, I mean, we don't do without anything, you know, that we need, then that's okay, because it was worth it. So it's more the state of mind that I get from them than, hey, we're doing something great. This is just their station in life and what they were able to do.
Thanks, Rhonda. Kevin, your response?
Your kid sounds great, Rhonda, yeah. And you sound like a wonderful mom. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I think one of the things that I love to challenge audiences with is I ask people two consecutive questions. The first question is, have you ever purchased something in which less than a week later you've regretted it? And every hand in the room will go up. And then I say, have you ever given either of your time or of your money and then later regretted that, even if your giving wasn't particularly effective? And you never see a hand. It's really a fascinating thing.
Our last caller from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Hunter. You're on the air. Thanks for being so patient, waiting so long.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me. Kevin, my comment is about you. I know your primary lesson is that, yes, we can do without less. We can do without so much stuff. We can do with less. The most important lesson that I heard today was that you heard Hannah when she said, wow, there's a discrepancy here, and we can make a difference ourselves. And her parents heard her. You heard her say that and acted on it, and that is amazing.
Well, thank you. We can learn an awful lot from our kids. I'll tell you, I get asked a lot, how do you raise philanthropic children? And I always tell people, well, she's raising philanthropic parents. So,
the interesting thing, though, when you have people over to your house now, to your current house, Hannah, how old are you now?
I'm 17.
You're 17.
Mm-hmm.
Does this come up in every conversation?
It comes up in many, but the people who know us very well are sick of it. So we like to talk about baseball and schools and all the things that people.
So Hannah, we have not a lot of time, but you've created all this change within your family, and this is a dramatic, huge thing. And you've written this book with your dad. What do you want for yourself? What are your dreams in life?
My main dream is to become a nurse. So now I'm kind of looking at nursing schools, and, I think that, you know, my whole life I'll be doing half projects. You know, as a nurse, I won't be making a lot of money, but, I do feel like I will be living a life of giving. So, I feel pretty good about that. And also I feel like I'll be giving, a lot of time and money to people I can help.
And what about the future for you, Kevin? What are you doing, and what do you hope to give to with the half that's left?
The coolest thing that I'm doing now is there's a social worker in some of the roughest schools in the city of Atlanta who loves the Power of Half platform and wants to start to use it to help kids feel more powerful about themselves.
More powerful about themselves to do something with that half of whatever they have to keep on giving.
Exactly, and be out there in the world for others.
Kevin Salwin, Hannah Salwin, The Power of Half, One Family's Decision to Stop Taking and Start Giving Back. Thanks to you both very much for being here today, and thanks for your book and for your contributions.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, really appreciate it, and good luck to you. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Stesno. Have a great day.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.